Marcone had been concerned about my talents. He'd started taking steps to balance things, and Marcone wasn't one to show his hand early, which meant that he was already prepared for trouble of one kind or another with me. He was ready to fight me. Marcone read my features and said, "Neither one of us wants any unpleasantness, Dresden." His eyes became flat and hard. "If you want to talk, call my office tomorrow. In the meantime, I suggest you search for your classic renditions of Elvis elsewhere." "I'll take it under advisement," I answered. Marcone shook his head and walked away to do his own mingling, which seemed to consist mainly of shaking hands and nodding in the appropriate spots. Hendrix and the Amazonian guard shadowed Marcone, never far away. "What a charmer you are," Susan murmured. I grunted. "Such diplomacy." "Me and Kissinger," I scowled after Marcone and said, "I don't like this." "Why not?" "Because he's up to something. He set up magical defenses around his house."
"Like he was expecting trouble," Susan said.
"Yeah."
"You think he's the buyer for the shroud?"
"Would make a lot of sense," I said. "He's got enough contacts and money to do it. The buy is apparently going down here, at his gala." I scanned the room as I spoke. "He doesn't do anything without planning it out to his advantage. He's probably got friends in hotel security. It would give him all kinds of freedom to meet Valmont where no one was watching." I spotted Marcone as he found a spot near a wall and lifted a tiny cell phone to his ear. He spoke into it, his eyes hard, and he had the look of a man who wasn't listening, only giving orders. I tried to listen in on what he was saying, but between the band, the ballroom, and the chatter of voices, I wasn't able to make anything out.
"But why?" Susan asked. "He's got the means and the resources, but what reason would he have to buy the shroud?"
"Hell if I know." Susan nodded. "He certainly isn't happy to see you here." "Yeah, something unsettled him, gave him a nasty surprise. Did you see his face?"
Susan shook her head. "What do you mean?"
"A reaction during the conversation. I'm sure I saw it. He got caught flat-footed when I was talking to him, and he didn't like it."
"You rattled him?"
"Maybe," I said.
"Enough to push him into moving early?"
Susan's dark eyes had also picked out Marcone, who snapped the cell phone closed and headed for one of the service doors with guard and Hendrix behind him. Marcone paused to speak to a red-jacketed security guard and glanced in our direction.
"Looks like we'd better get moving," I said.
"I need a minute to use the spell on this thread sample and lead us to the shroud."
"Why haven't you done that already?"
"Limited range," I said, "and the spell won't last long. We need to be close."
"How close?" Susan asked.
"Maybe 100 feet. Marcone left the room, and the security guard lifted his radio to his mouth.
"Crap," I said.
"Relax," Susan said, though her own voice sounded tight. "These are the upper crust of Chicago. The security guards won't want to make a scene."
"Right,"
I said, and started for the door.
"Slowly,"
Susan said, her smile in place again.
"Don't rush."
I tried not to rush, despite the security guard closing in behind us. I saw red jackets moving in my peripheral vision as well. We kept up the slow, graceful walk of people wandering around a party, and Susan smiled enough for both of us. We got as far as the doors before another red jacket appeared in the doors in front of us, cutting us off. I recognized the man, the gunman outside the television studio, the one who had nearly ventilated Father Vincent and me in the parking garage. His eyes widened in recognition and his hand moved toward his jacket, where a gun would be inside a shoulder holster. The body language was clear. Come along quietly or get shot. I looked around us, but other than the partygoers, the dance floor, and the other security guards, nothing really seemed to present itself as an option. Then the band struck up something a little faster with a syncopated Latin beat, and several of the younger couples who hadn't been dancing previously moved out onto the floor.
Come on, I said, and guided Susan with me.
What are you doing? She asked.
Buying some time to get across the room to those other doors, I said.
I turned to her, put one hand on her waist, and took her other hand in mine, and led off onto the dance floor with an uncomplicated two-step.
Just follow.
I looked back to her to see her mouth open in shock.
You told me you couldn't dance.
Not like in clubs and stuff, I said. She followed me well enough to let me do a little dip and step into a restrained hustle. I don't do so well with rock and roll.
ballroom is something else. Susan laughed, her dark eyes shining, even as she watched the crowd around us for more red jackets.
Between this and the tux, you're threatening to become classy. Where did you learn?
I kept us moving down the dance floor, rolling Susan out to the length of our arms, and then drawing her in again. When I first came to Chicago, I had a bunch of jobs, until I hooked up with Nick Christian at Ragged Angel Investigations. One of them was as a dance partner with a senior citizen organization.
You learned from little old ladies?
Tough to tango with someone with lumbago, I said. It requires great skill. I spun Susan again, this time bringing her back to me with her back to my chest, one hand still on her hip, with the other holding her arm out. There was a subtle electricity in touching her. Her waist slender and supple under my hand. Her hair smelled of cinnamon, and her dress left quite a bit of her back naked to view.